This is Audible.
The Expectant Father, the Ultimate Guide for Dads-to-Be. Written by Armin Brott and Jennifer Ash. Read by Armin Brott. Introduction. When my wife got pregnant with our first child, I was the happiest I'd ever been. That pregnancy, labor, and the baby's birth was a time of incredible closeness, tenderness, and passion. Long before we'd married, my wife and I had made a commitment to participate equally in raising our children, and it seemed only natural that the process of shared parenting should begin during pregnancy. Since neither of us had had children before, we were both rather ill-prepared for pregnancy. Fortunately for my wife, there were literally hundreds of books and other resources designed to educate, encourage, support, and comfort women during their pregnancies. But when it finally hit me that I, too, was expecting, although in a very different kind of way, and that the pregnancy was bringing out feelings and emotions I didn't understand, there simply weren't any resources for me to turn to. I looked for answers in my wife's pregnancy books, but information about what expectant fathers go through, if it was discussed at all, was at best superficial and consisted mostly of advice on how men could be supportive of their pregnant wives. To make things worse, my wife and I were the first couple in our circle of close friends to get pregnant, which meant that there was no one else I could talk to about what I was going through, no one who could reassure me that what I was feeling was normal and all right. Until fairly recently, there has been precious little research on expectant fathers' emotional and psychological experiences during pregnancy. The very title of one of the first articles to appear on the subject should give you some idea of the medical and psychiatric community's attitude toward the impact of pregnancy on men. It was written by William H. Wainwright, M.D., and published in the July 1966 issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. The title? Fatherhood as a Precipitant of Mental Illness. Another wonderful article that came out about the same time was Psychoses in Males in Relation to Their Wives' Pregnancy and Childbirth. As you'll soon find out, though, an expectant father's experience during the transition to fatherhood is not confined simply to excitement or mental illness. If it were, this book never would have been written. The reality is that men's emotional response to pregnancy is no less varied than women's. Expectant fathers feel everything from relief to denial, fear to frustration, anger to joy, and for up to 80% of men, there are physical symptoms of pregnancy as well. We'll talk more about this in the third month. So why haven't men's experiences been discussed more? Now, in my opinion, it's because we as a society value motherhood more than fatherhood, and we automatically assume that issues of pregnancy, childbirth, and child rearing are women's issues. But as you'll learn, both from this book and from your own experience, that's simply not the case. Who exactly has written this book? From the very beginning, my goal in writing The Expectant Father has been to help you, the dad-to-be, understand and make sense of what you're going through during your partner's pregnancy. The rationale was simple. The more you understand about what you're going through, the better prepared you'll be and the more likely you'll be to take an interest in and stay involved throughout the pregnancy. Research has shown that the earlier fathers get involved, and what could be earlier than pregnancy, the more likely they are to be involved after their children are born, and that's good for your child, good for you, and good for your relationship with your child's mother. All that's very nice, of course, but it's clearly dependent on your partner's actually being pregnant. So a good understanding of her perspective on the pregnancy, emotional as well as physical, is essential to understanding how you will react. It was precisely this perspective that Jennifer Ash, along with my wife and hundreds of other expectant and new mothers I've interviewed over the years, provided. Throughout the process of writing the book, all of these women contributed valuable information and comments, not only about what pregnant women are going through, but also about the ways women most want men to be involved, and the impact that involvement has on the entire pregnancy experience. A note on structure. Throughout the book, I try to present straightforward, practical information in an easy-to-absorb format. Each of the main chapters is divided into four sections as follows. What's going on with the baby? You can't very well have a pregnancy without a baby, right? This section lets you in on your future child's progress from sperm and egg to living, breathing infant, and everything in between. What's going on with your partner? Even though this is a book about what you, as an expectant father, are going through during pregnancy and how you can best stay involved, it's critical that you understand what your partner is going through and when. For that reason, we felt that it was important to include in each chapter a summary of her physical and emotional pregnancy experience. What's going on with you? This section covers the wide range of feelings, good, bad, and indifferent, that you'll probably experience at some time during the pregnancy. It also describes such things as the physical changes you may go through, your dreams, your changing values, your relationships with other people, and the ways the pregnancy may affect your sex life. Staying involved. While the What's Going On With You section covers the emotional and physical side of pregnancy, this section gives you specific facts, tips, and advice on what you can do to make the pregnancy yours as well as your partner's. For instance, you'll find information on how to help your partner eat right and exercise, guidance on how to start a college fund for the baby, valuable advice on getting the most out of your birth classes, great ways to start communicating with your baby before he or she is born, tips on finding work-family balance. Here's a hint, there's actually no such thing, but with planning, you may be able to get close. And sprinkled throughout, you'll find suggestions for how to be supportive of your partner and how to stay included at every stage of the pregnancy. The Expectant Father covers more than the 9 months of pregnancy. We've included a detailed chapter on labor and delivery and another on cesarean section, both of which will prepare you for the big event and how best to help your partner through the birth itself. Perhaps even more important, these chapters prepare you for the often overwhelming emotions you may experience when your partner is in labor and your child is being born. We've also included a special chapter that addresses the major questions and concerns you may have about caring for and getting to know your child in the first few weeks after you bring him or her home. If someone hasn't bought them for you already, I'd recommend that you rush right out and get copies of The New Father, A Dad's Guide to the First Year, and Fathering Your Toddler, A Dad's Guide to the Second and Third Years. These books pick up where this one leaves off and continue the process of giving you the skills, knowledge, confidence, and support you'll need to be the best possible dad. They're both available as physical books and as ebooks. Toward the end of this book, there's a chapter called Fathering Today, in which you'll learn to recognize and overcome the many obstacles you may encounter along the road to becoming an actively involved dad. As you go through the expectant father, remember that the process of becoming a dad is different for every man and that none of us will react to the same situation in exactly the same way. You may find that some of what's described in the What's Going On With You section in the third month chapter won't really ring true for you until the fifth month, or that you already experienced it in the first month. I've tried to tie the ideas and activities in the Staying Involved sections to specific stages of the pregnancy. But hey, it's your baby, so if you want to do things in a different order, knock yourself out. A quick note on terminology: wife, girlfriend, lover, he, she. In an attempt to avoid offending anyone, which is an approach I've discovered usually ends up offending everyone, we've decided to refer to the woman who's carrying your baby as your partner. And because your partner is just as likely to be carrying a boy as a girl, we've alternated between he and she when referring to the baby, except where something specifically applies to boys or girls. Hospitals, doctors. Not everyone who has a baby delivers in a hospital or is under the care of a medical doctor. Still, because that's the most frequent scenario, we've chosen to refer to the place where the baby will be born as the hospital, and to the people attending the birth, besides you, of course, as doctors, nurses, medical professionals, or practitioners. Again, except in the sections that specifically deal with home birth and or midwives. As a rule, today's dads and expectant dads want to be much more involved with their children than their own fathers were able to be. It's my firm belief that the first step on the road toward full involvement is to take an active role in the pregnancy. And it's our hope that when you're through reading The Expectant Father, which is the book Jennifer wishes she could have bought for her husband when she was pregnant, and the one I wish I'd had when I was an expectant dad, you'll be much better prepared to participate in this important new phase of your life. So why should you get involved now before you actually become a dad? Simply put, because it's good for your child, your partner, and yourself. As I said, involvement during pregnancy is a good predictor of involvement after the pregnancy, and children who grow up in homes where the dad is involved do better in math and science, they're more sociable, they're more tenacious when solving problems and thinking way out into the future, they're less likely to use drugs and alcohol or become teen parents. When the dad-to-be is involved during the pregnancy, he and his partner are more likely to be together for their child's third birthday than partnerships in which the dad isn't as involved. Pregnant women whose partners are involved prenatally are more likely to get prenatal care, and if they smoke, they're more likely to quit. According to researcher Jacinta Bronte Tinkyu, women whose partners aren't supportive during the pregnancy are more likely to view their pregnancy as unwanted. Finally, your being involved now makes it more likely that your partner will breastfeed your baby, and we'll talk about why that's so important later on. For you, being an involved dad will reduce the chance that you'll engage in risky behavior. You'll probably start taking better care of yourself. You'll be happier in your relationship with your partner, and you'll even perform better at work. What's new in this edition? In the years since the first edition of The Expectant Father was published, I've received literally thousands of emails and letters, and yes, people still do send letters, from readers offering comments and suggestions on how to make this book better. I've incorporated many of them into this edition, and I know the book is greatly improved as a result. Let me give you a quick rundown. Adoptive fathers. Although your partner may not actually be carrying a baby, the two of you are still very much psychologically pregnant. There's a lot of research, in fact, that suggested in the months leading up to the adoption of their child, expectant adoptive fathers deal with many of the same emotional and psychological issues that biologically expectant fathers do. Multiples. We've expanded the sections geared toward expectant fathers of twins, triplets, and so forth. Overcoming infertility. As the average age of new parents increases, more and more couples are experiencing infertility. So we've included a whole chapter on infertility, as well as information on what you can do to increase the chances that you and your partner will conceive. The art of fatherhood, and that's A-R-T. An increasing number of couples are conceiving through the use of ART, assisted or artificial reproductive technology, which includes IVF, that's in vitro fertilization, artificial insemination, donor sperm, donor eggs, and gestational carriers, who used to be referred to as surrogates. We've included a number of sections that deal with the fascinating issues facing ART dads and their partners. GI dads. Every year, a huge number of service members from all branches of the service spend at least part of their partner's pregnancy thousands of miles away. Many of them come home to a child who was born while they were deployed. As a Marine myself, I got out long ago, but as we all know, there's no such thing as an ex-Marine. I knew I needed to do as much as I could to help our service members. For that reason, we've included several sections in this book designed to help expectant military dads stay involved before, during, and after the pregnancy so that they can hit the ground running when they get back home. I go into these issues in much more detail in my book, The Military Father, A Hands-On Guide for Deployed Dads. We need your help. I'd love to hear your experiences, feelings, comments, and suggestions, and I'll try to incorporate them into future editions of this book. You can email me at armin@mrdad.com, and as long as you're online, there are lots of other ways to be in touch. My website is mrdad.com, and you can follow me on social media too. Now, close your eyes, take a deep breath, and let's get you started on this new and wonderful stage of your life. First decisions. Among the first major questions you and your partner will face after learning she's pregnant are, where are we going to have the baby? Who's going to help us deliver it? And how much is it all going to cost? To a certain extent, the answers will be dictated by your health insurer, but there are still a range of options to consider. As you weigh your choices, give your partner at least 51% of the votes. After all, the ultimate decision really affects her more than it does you. First, there's the where and the how. Let's start with hospitals. For most couples, especially first-time parents, the hospital is the most common place to give birth. It's also, in many people's view, the safest. In the unlikely event that complications arise, most hospitals have specialists on staff 24 hours a day, and they're equipped with all the necessary life-saving equipment and medications. And in those first hectic hours or days after the birth, the on-staff nurses monitor the baby and mother and help both new parents with the dozens of questions that are likely to come up. They also run interference for you and help fend off unwanted intrusions. If you have a choice among several hospitals in your area, be sure to take a tour of each one before making your decision. Most of the time, you'll end up going with the hospital where your partner's doctor or midwife has privileges, or where your insurance plan says you can go. Some people do it the other way around. They select the hospital first and then find a practitioner who's associated with that hospital. Many hospitals now have birthing rooms or entire birthing centers that are carefully decorated to look less sterile and medical and more like a bedroom at home, although the effect is really more like a nice motel suite or a quaint bed and breakfast. The cozy decor is supposed to make you and your partner feel more comfortable, but with the wood furniture cleverly concealing sophisticated monitoring equipment and the cabinets full of sterile supplies and nurses dropping by every hour or so to give your partner a pelvic exam, it's going to be hard to forget where you are. Keep in mind that at some hospitals, birthing rooms are assigned on a first-come, first-served basis, so don't count on getting one unless you can convince your partner to go into labor before anyone else does that day. In a lot of other hospitals, all the labor rooms are also birthing rooms, so this won't be an issue. Hospitals, by their nature, are pretty busy places, and they have all sorts of rules and policies that may or may not make sense to you. Giving birth in a hospital generally involves less privacy for you and your partner and more routine and sometimes intrusive procedures for her and the baby. That said, if your partner is considered high risk, and her doctor will let her know if she is, a hospital birth will and should be your only choice. Another option is freestanding birthing centers. Of the 1-2% of births that take place outside a hospital, about 30% happen in private birthing centers, usually staffed by certified nurse midwives, CNMs. These facilities tend to offer a more personal approach to the birthing process. They look and feel a lot like home, nice wallpaper, hot tubs, and sometimes even a kitchen. They're generally less rigid than hospitals and more willing to accommodate any special requests your partner or you may have. For example, there are fewer routine medical interventions. Your partner may be allowed to eat during labor, which is a big no-no at most hospitals, and she'll be able to wear her own clothes, none of those unflattering hospital gowns unless she really wants one. The staff will also try to make sure your partner and baby are never separated. One downside is that you and your newly expanded family may need to check out as soon as 6 to 10 hours after the birth. Private birthing centers are designed to deal with uncomplicated, low-risk pregnancies and births, so expect to be pre-screened. And don't worry, if something doesn't go exactly as planned, birthing centers are always affiliated with a doctor and are usually either attached to a hospital or only a short ambulance ride away. If you're interested in exploring this option, start by getting a recommendation from your partner's practitioner or friends and family. Or you can contact the American Association of Birth Centers at birthcenters.org. Home birth. With all their high-tech efficiency and stark, impersonal, antiseptic conditions, hospitals are not for everyone. As a result, some couples, it's actually less than 1%, decide to have their baby at home. Home birth has been around forever. In fact, before 1920, that's where most births happened, but it's been out of favor in this country for a long time. It is, however, making something of a comeback. My wife and I thought about a home birth for our second baby, but ultimately decided against it. While I don't consider myself particularly squeamish, I just couldn't imagine how we'd avoid making a mess all over the bedroom carpet. What really clinched it for us, though, was that our first child had been an emergency cesarean section. Fearing that we might run into problems again, we opted to be near the doctors. If you're thinking about a home birth, be prepared. Having a baby at home is quite a bit different from the way it's made out to be in those old westerns. You'll need to assume much more responsibility for the whole process than if you were checked in at a hospital. It takes a ton of research and preparation. At the very least, you're going to need a lot more than clean towels and boiling water. Making the decision to give birth at home does not mean that your partner can skip getting prenatal care or that the two of you should plan on delivering your baby alone. You still need to be in close contact with a medical professional to ensure that the pregnancy is progressing normally. And you should make sure to have someone present at the birth who has plenty of experience with childbirth. And no, not your sister or your mother-in-law, unless they happen to be medically qualified. So if you're planning on going this route, start working on selecting a midwife right now. Statistically, it's pretty unlikely that you'll go this route. But in case you're considering it, I want to take you through some of the reasons people commonly give for wanting to have their baby at home and some situations that would make a home birth unnecessarily risky. Here's why some couples opt for home birth. The surroundings are more familiar, comfortable, and private. They don't like or they're afraid of hospitals and doctors, or they had a negative experience with a previous birth. They might have already had one or more uncomplicated hospital births. You can surround yourselves with anyone you pick. The birth is more likely to go exactly as you want than it might go anywhere else. And your partner will be treated less like a patient than she would be in a hospital. You can pay attention to the spiritual aspects of the delivery, an intimate matter that you might be discouraged from or feel embarrassed about in the hospital. Hospitals are full of sick people, and it's best to stay far away from them. And finally, having a baby at home is a lot cheaper. But even if you want one, there are a number of scenarios that could make a home birth too risky. For example, your partner is over 35 or has been told by her doctor that she's high risk. She's carrying twins or more, or you find out that the baby is breech, which is feet down instead of head down. She goes into labor prematurely, or she's developed preeclampsia, a condition that affects about 10% of pregnant women and that can have very serious complications if it's not detected and treated early. She has diabetes or a heart or kidney condition, has had hemorrhaging in a previous labor, has had a previous cesarean section, or smokes cigarettes. And finally, if she's got no insurance coverage. Now, let's talk about some of the other issues you'll need to consider. First, there's the question of natural versus medicated birth. In recent years, giving birth naturally, meaning without drugs, pain medication, or any medical intervention, has become all the rage. But just because it's popular doesn't mean it's for everyone. Labor and delivery are going to be a painful experience for both of you, although in different ways, and many couples elect to take advantage of the advances medical science has made in relieving the pain and discomfort of childbirth. Whichever way you go, make sure the decision is your partner's. Proponents of some childbirth methods are almost religiously committed to the idea of a drug-free delivery, to the extent that they often make women who opt for any pain medication feel that they've failed. Besides making a lot of new parents feel bad about themselves when they should be celebrating the birth of their baby, that kind of militant attitude is simply out of touch with reality. Nationwide, about half of women give birth using an epidural, which is the most common method of pain relief, and in some big city hospitals, that rate is north of 85%. There are advantages and disadvantages to both medicated and unmedicated births, and we'll talk about them when we get closer to your baby's due date. But for now, the most important thing is to be flexible and not let your friends, relatives, or anyone else pressure you into doing something you don't want to do. You and your partner may be planning a natural childbirth, but conditions could develop that necessitate intervention or the use of medication. On the other hand, you may be planning a medicated delivery, but could find yourself snowed in someplace far from your hospital and any pain medication, or the anesthesiologist may be at an emergency on the other side of town. All right, we've covered the where and the how. Now, let's move on to the who's going to help part. At first glance, it may seem that your partner should be picking a medical practitioner alone. After all, she's the one who's going to be poked and prodded as the pregnancy develops. But considering that more than 90% of today's expectant fathers are present during the delivery of their children, and that the vast majority of them have been involved in some significant way during the rest of the pregnancy, you're probably going to be spending a lot of time with the practitioner as well. So, if at all possible, you should feel comfortable with the final choice too. Here are the main players. Let's start with private obstetricians. If your partner is over 20, she's probably been seeing a gynecologist for a few years, and since many gynecologists also do obstetrics, it should come as no surprise that most couples elect to have the woman's regular obstetrician-gynecologist, or OBGYN, deliver the baby. Private OBGYNs are generally the most expensive way to go, but your insurance company will probably pick up a good part of the bill. Most private OBs, however, aren't strictly private. They usually have a number of partners, which means that the doctor you see for your prenatal appointments might not be the one in attendance at the birth. So make sure that you're aware of and comfortable with the backup arrangements, just in case your baby decides to show up on a day when your regular doctor isn't on call. Labor and delivery are going to be stressful enough without having to deal with a doctor you've never met before. Researcher Sandra Howell-White found that women who view childbirth as risky or who want to have a say in managing their pain or the length of their labor tend to opt for obstetricians. Next, we've got family physicians, or FPs. Although many FPs provide obstetrical care, not all do, so check with yours to see whether he or she does. If not, your FP will refer your partner to someone else for the pregnancy and birth. One of the big advantages of going with your family doctor is that after the birth, he or she often can see your partner and baby on the same visit. The time saved running around from doctor to doctor will be welcome. Like most doctors, FPs are frequently in group practices, and there's no guarantee that the doctor you know will be on call the day the baby comes. So if you can, try to meet with the other doctors in the practice, as well as any OBGYNs your family doctor might work with. Most FPs can't do C-sections, for example, or assisted deliveries, and they'll need OBGYN backup. In addition, since malpractice insurance covering maternity care and childbirth is very expensive, many FPs will refer pregnant patients to an OB who already has that coverage. Make sure you're comfortable with this person, since he or she may be doing the delivery if things get complicated. Midwives. Although midwives are not as common in the United States as they are in Europe and other parts of the world, they are becoming increasingly popular, and you might want to consider bringing one into the process even if your partner has a regular OB. In Howell White's study, women who expect their partners to be actively involved in labor and delivery and who place a high value on getting information on the birth process are more likely to opt for a midwife. Interestingly, so are women who have no religious affiliation. Certified nurse midwives, CNMs, are licensed nurses who have taken a minimum of 2 or 3 years of additional training in obstetrics and passed special certification exams. They can deliver babies in hospitals, birthing centers, or at home. But because their training is usually in uncomplicated low-risk births, CNMs have to work under a physician just in case something comes up. Some states have created a new designation, Certified Midwife, or CM, which allows practitioners who aren't nurses but who go through the same training and take the same exams as CNMs to work as midwives. Many standard OBGYN practices recognize that some of their patients might want to have a midwife in attendance at the birth, so they now have a CNM, or in some cases a CM, on staff. Officially, then, your partner is still under the care of a physician, whose services can be paid for by insurance, but she'll still get the more personalized care she wants. Keep in mind, though, that because midwives aren't MDs, they can't perform surgery, and they're able to handle only low-risk cases. If you're considering using a CNM or a CM and need some help with your search, the American College of Nurse Midwives can put you in touch with one in your area and fill you in on any applicable regulations. They're online at midwife.org. If you've already found a midwife but want to be sure she's properly certified, visit the American Midwifery Certification Board at amcbmidwife.org. There are also plenty of midwives out there who are neither certified nor licensed. Lay midwives have a lot of experience working with pregnant women and may even have a lot of specialized training, but they're not regulated and may not have passed any specific midwife's exams, which means that in most cases, they can work in home settings but not in hospitals or birthing centers. Like CNMs or CMs, lay midwives must work with a physician in case there's an emergency. The Midwives Alliance of North America, MANA.org, can help you find out more about lay midwives and put you in touch with one near you. Then, there are doulas. Although it sounds like it should mean a miniature doula, doula is actually a Greek word that means a woman caregiver of another woman. Many doulas have had children of their own, and all of them go through an intensive training period in which they are taught how to give the laboring woman and her partner emotional and physical support throughout the labor and information about the delivery. Doulas have become increasingly popular over the years, and we'll talk a lot more about them when we get closer to the birth. For now, though, as you're just beginning the process, there's one very important thing to think about. Doulas are not medical professionals. They're generally not regulated, and they may not be particularly welcome in hospitals. Here's how childbirth educator Sarah McMoyler and I described in our book, The Best Birth, the sometimes combative relationships that can develop. The problem is that some doulas have an agenda and see their role as protecting mom and baby from what they believe are unnecessary interventions. Sometimes they take that agenda a couple steps too far and start playing doctor, inserting their non-medical opinion into a science-based hospital arena. As you can imagine, this can create tension and confusion and is, frankly, completely inappropriate. Because this kind of attitude can interfere with the medical team's ability to do its job, a number of OBGYN practices and hospitals around the country have banned doulas from their delivery rooms. That said, several studies have shown that having a doula may reduce the length of labor. But before you plunk down a deposit, check with your OB. Whether you're thinking about an OBGYN, a family physician, a midwife, or some combination, before you make your final decision, you're going to want to meet with him or her and ask a bunch of questions. We've got a list of what those questions should be in the PDF that accompanies this audiobook. Now, let's talk money. Having a baby isn't cheap. Exactly how much you have to come up with will depend on how and where your baby is born and which of the infinite combinations of deductible, coinsurance, copays, and out-of-pocket maximums you have. According to the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, which is part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the average charge for a vaginal delivery is just under $9,000, nearly triple what it was in 1993. And the average charge for a cesarean section is almost $16,000, 2.5 times what it was in 1993. Private insurance covers an average of 80% of prenatal care charges and 88% of delivery charges. But even if you have good insurance, that 12 to 20% can still add up in a hurry. Do keep in mind, though, that what the practitioner receives will almost always be quite a bit less than the sticker price. Over the next few minutes, you'll get an idea of how the costs for a typical and not-so-typical pregnancy and childbirth experience might break down. It's a good idea to look over your insurance policy, find out how much it will be picking up, and start figuring out now how you're going to pay for the rest of it. Oh, and all of this is in addition to anything you might have paid for fertility diagnosis and treatment. What we're talking about here are just the costs that come up after your partner gets pregnant. If you're adopting, putting together a budget is still very important to do. In many cases, adoptive parents are in close contact with the birth mother throughout her pregnancy and delivery. You and your partner might go with her to the doctor's appointments, see the ultrasound, hear the baby's heartbeat, and pick up the bills, most of which won't be reimbursed by your insurance company. If you're doing an international adoption, you won't have to worry about covering the birth mother's medical expenses, but you'll probably need to budget in the cost of several overseas trips. In addition, you'll need to take into account the many other adoption-related expenses you're likely to incur, including agency fees, attorney's fees, and the home study you'll have to go through. Pregnancy and childbirth. Most doctors will charge a flat fee for your partner's care during the entire pregnancy. This generally covers monthly visits during the first two trimesters, biweekly visits for the next month or so, and then weekly visits until delivery. But don't make the mistake of thinking that that's all you'll pay. Bills for blood and urine tests, ultrasounds, hospital fees, and other procedures will work their way into your mailbox at least once a month. Here's what you can expect to pay before your insurance picks up its part for having your baby. If you're going with an OBGYN, expect to pay $2,500 to $6,500 for general prenatal care and a problem-free vaginal delivery. Add a few thousand more for a C-section. Most doctors will meet with you to discuss their rates and the services they provide. In addition, be sure to discuss which insurance plans, if any, they participate in. It might actually be easier to start with the doctors your insurance already covers and work backwards from there. You should also ask whether they'll bill your insurance company directly or will want you to make a deposit. Most will want to collect about 25% of the anticipated bill up front. Whether you can make your payments in installments and whether they expect their fee to be paid in full before the delivery. If you're using a midwife, the average cost of a delivery is $2,000 to $4,000, but it can vary greatly depending on where you live and whether you expect her to be with you throughout the labor or just the part that's right before the birth. If you're delivering it at home, you'll also need to add the cost of the supplies the midwife thinks you'll need for the birth, sterile pads, bandages, and so forth. Lab and other expenses. Over the course of the pregnancy, you can expect to be billed anywhere from $200 to $1,500 for various blood tests, and ultrasounds are at least $250 apiece. In an ordinary pregnancy, you'll have between 0 and 3. Prenatal testing. If you and or your practitioner decide that your partner is a candidate for amniocentesis or any other prenatal diagnostic test, you can expect to pay $1,000 to $1,500. In most cases, genetic counseling is required beforehand, and that costs an additional $400 to $600. If you're having any prenatal testing done just because you'd like to find out the sex of the baby or because you want reassurance of its well-being, your insurance company may not pay for it. But if your partner is 35 or older, or she is in one of the high-risk categories, they probably will pay for the testing. At the hospital. If you're paying for it yourself, a problem-free vaginal delivery and a 24-hour stay in a hospital will run anywhere from $4,500 to $9,000, depending on where you live, and $5,000 to $7,000 for a cesarean. If you're planning to spend the night in the hospital with your partner, add about $250 per day. Anesthesiologists usually charge from $1,000 to $1,500 depending on what they do and how much time they spend doing it. Although a lot of people worry about preterm delivery, there's also the issue of late delivery. If your baby decides to stay inside any more than 7 to 10 days past his due date, your partner may need to have labor induced. If that happens, add another $1,000 to $3,000. If your partner does deliver early, by more than a couple weeks, and your baby needs to spend time in intensive care, the bills, most of which you will hopefully never see, can go into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. If your partner ends up having a C-section, which happens more than 30% of the time, that's up from 21% in 1993, all bets are off. Even though it's routinely done, it's still considered major surgery and it's expensive. The operation, which your OBGYN will probably perform, is not included in his or her flat fee, and you'll have to pay for at least two other doctors to assist, plus a nurse who must be in attendance to care for the baby. In addition, a C-section requires a longer recovery period in the hospital, usually 4 to 5 days, as well as extra nursing care, pain medication, bandages, and other supplies. If the baby's in good health, you can probably take him home while your partner stays in the hospital, but chances are you'll want the baby to stay with mom, especially if she's breastfeeding. The baby's additional time in the nursery costs more too. Here's an important and possibly profitable word of advice. Make sure that you and your partner check your birth-related bills very carefully. Hospitals can make mistakes. In fact, a study by credit giant Equifax found that 9 out of 10 hospital bills contain errors, and they're rarely in your favor. After we'd recovered from the shock of the C-section bills for the birth of our first child, which started off at about $17,000, we asked a doctor friend to go over them with us. He found that we'd been charged for a variety of things that hadn't happened and overcharged for a lot of the things that did. For example, we'd been billed $25 for a tube of ointment that the hospital's own pharmacy was selling for $1.25. We, actually mostly our insurance company, ended up paying closer to $15,000. And for the second pregnancy, our nitpicking review of the bills cut about 20% off the total. Look for double billings, services you never received, say a private room when you were actually in a shared one, or brand name drugs when you actually got generics, and any kind of suspicious jargon. A wonderful expose done by ABC News found that people had been billed hundreds of dollars for a disposable mucus recovery system, that was a 79-cent box of tissues, and thermal therapy, which was ice cubes in a bag. Also, keep an eye out for procedures that never happened. I've heard stories about new parents being billed for their baby's circumcision, which would have been fine, except that they had a girl. While some of these things may seem silly, they can really add up, especially if you're footing a big portion of the bill yourself. In the Equifax study, the average error was more than $1,300. And according to a joint study done by Harvard's medical and law schools, nearly half of all Americans who file for bankruptcy do so because of medical expenses. About 10% of those are childbirth related. Even if all the bills are being paid by your insurance, reviewing those bills can still be profitable. Although most insurance companies have their own internal auditors, All they'll be able to catch are charges that are above the usual and customary, or procedures that simply aren't covered. They won't know about most of the things I just mentioned, and they'll be ecstatic if your review ends up saving them money. In fact, some insurers are so thrilled that they'll actually give you a percentage, sometimes as much as half, of the money they save. Naturally, though, you'll have to ask for your reward. So read your policy carefully, and if you still have questions, talk to your agent or one of the company's underwriters. And while you're reading your insurance policy, here are a few other things to look out for. How long before the birth does the insurer need to be notified about the pregnancy and estimated due date? Not complying with the carrier's instructions could mean a reduction in the amount they'll pay for pregnancy and birth-related expenses. When can the baby be added to the policy? Until the baby is born, all pregnancy and birth-related expenses will be charged to your partner. After the birth, however, your partner and the new baby get separate bills. All baby-related expenses such as medication, pediatrician's exams, diapers, blankets, and various other hospital charges will be charged to the baby. Some carriers require that you add the baby to your or your partner's policy as much as 30 days before the birth, but most give you until 30 days after. Again, failing to follow the insurer's instructions could result in a reduction of coverage. Let's talk quickly about some low-cost alternatives. If you live in a city where there's a large teaching hospital, your partner may be able to get prenatal care at its obstetrical clinic. If so, you'll spend a lot less than you would for a private physician. The one drawback is that your baby will probably be delivered by an inexperienced, yet closely supervised, doctor or a medical student. This isn't to say that you won't be getting top-quality care. Clinics are often equipped with state-of-the-art facilities, and the young professionals who staff them are being taught all the latest methods by some of the best teachers in the country. If worse comes to worst, hospital emergency rooms are required by federal law to give your partner an initial assessment and any required emergency care, even if you can't afford to pay. But that's no substitute for the kind of ongoing prenatal care that will ensure a healthy pregnancy, healthy baby, and a healthy mom. So if you're uninsured or underinsured, and according to the American Pregnancy Association, that's the case for 13% of pregnant women, or you just need some help paying for the prenatal care your partner needs, your first step should be to find out what Medicaid benefits she's eligible for. If you're in this category, don't feel bad. Nearly half of all births in the U.S. are financed by Medicaid. Since benefits vary by state, make contact with your state's health department as well. You'll be able to get most of your questions answered at the Medicaid website, medicaid.gov. Okay, now that we've covered the basics, in the next chapter, we'll talk about what you can expect in the first month of the pregnancy. The first month, salad days. What's going on with the baby? It's going to be a busy first month. About 2 hours after you had sex, one very lucky sperm will have fertilized the egg, and voila, you've got yourself a zygote. By the end of the day, the zygote will divide into two cells and is now technically an embryo. Your tiny bundle of cells will continue to divide, and 4 to 7 days after conception, it will implant itself comfortably into the wall of your partner's uterus, where it'll stay until birth. By the end of this month, your little embryo will be about a quarter inch long, 10,000 times bigger than when it was just a zygote, and will have a heart but no brain, and tiny arm and leg buds. Fresh or frozen? Whether your baby was conceived in a lab or a bed, your future child will develop in the same way. A few days after conception, the embryo, now about 8 cells, may be implanted in your partner's uterus. Some clinics wait a few more days until the embryo develops into a blastocyst. The reason is that in the wild, fertilization usually takes place in the fallopian tubes, and the embryo travels for a few days until arriving in the uterus, where it implants in the wall. Not all embryos, however, develop into blastocysts, so waiting until they do gives your fertility doc a better shot at implanting something that has a strong chance of survival. If you're doing IVF, the eggs you use will come either from your partner or another woman, and you can order them in one of two ways, fresh or frozen. Fresh embryos result in somewhat more pregnancies and live births than frozen ones. However, fresh isn't always a possibility. Say, the eggs may have been fertilized before you or your partner went through a medical procedure like chemotherapy that could potentially have damaged either her eggs or your sperm. Or the eggs may have been retrieved from a faraway donor. Interestingly, fresh eggs may not always be better. In independent studies, researchers in Finland, the U.S., and Australia all found that while defrosted embryos resulted in fewer pregnancies, the babies that are produced that way are less likely to be born prematurely, be born underweight, or die soon after birth. No one has any idea why that is. What's going on with your partner? Your partner may already be changing into a different person. Physically, she may be experiencing morning sickness with all its nausea, heartburn, and vomiting. She may have food cravings or aversions. She may be feeling tired, dizzy, irritable, and she may have headaches. Her breasts are changing too, becoming tender and enlarged. Emotionally, she may be thrilled, stunned, a little frightened, or even completely bummed out that she's pregnant. After all, not all pregnancies are planned. Sometimes she might feel all of these at the same time. She may be feeling especially close to you, but a little apprehensive about the 9 months ahead, and she may have mood swings and possibly some sudden, unexplained crying. What's going on with you? Thrills. I still have the white bathrobe I was wearing the morning my wife and I found out we were expecting for the first time. I remember standing nervously in the kitchen, the countertop cluttered with vials of colored powders and liquids, droppers, and the small container filled with my wife's first morning urine. Fortunately, do-it-yourself pregnancy detection kits are a lot less complicated today than they used to be, but I'm not sure they're anywhere near as much fun. I remember feeling like a Nobel Prize-winning chemist on the edge of making a discovery that would alter the course of the entire world. I carefully dropped several drops of the urine into one of the vials of powder. I stirred the mixture with the specially provided swizzle stick, rinsed it, and slowly added the contents of the other vial. In all honesty, the results we got 20 minutes later weren't much of a surprise, but that didn't make it any less thrilling. I'd always wanted to have children, and suddenly it seemed that all my dreams were finally going to come true. It was like hitting the $1 million jackpot on a nickel slot. Relief and pride. The pregnancy test's positive result filled me with an incredible feeling of relief. Secretly, I'd always been afraid that I was sterile and that I'd have to be satisfied with taking someone else's kids to the circus or baseball games. I also felt a surge of pride. After all, I was a man, a fully functional man. All right, a stud even. And by getting my wife pregnant, I'd somehow lived up to my highest potential. If you're not the biological father of your child, say your partner conceived using donor sperm, you probably won't have these feelings, but that in no way means that you're any less manly or that you're going to be any less of a dad than the rest of us. Many expectant ART dads, again that's artificial reproductive technology, feel a different kind of relief. All those months and years of infertility treatments, the emotional ups and downs, the optimism and disappointment are now a thing of the past. Other dads take longer to get to this point, and some never completely shake the infertility mentality. Irrational fears. At some point, after the initial excitement passes, a surprising number of men find themselves experiencing a strange fear that the child their partner is carrying is not theirs. Psychologist Gerald Lee Shapiro interviewed more than 200 men whose partners were pregnant and found that 60% of them admitted to having fleeting thoughts, fantasies, or nagging doubts that they might not really be the biological father of the child. The majority of these men didn't actually believe their partners were having affairs. Rather, Shapiro writes, these feelings are symptoms of a common type of insecurity. The fear many men have that they simply aren't capable of doing anything as incredible as creating life, and that someone more potent must have done the job. Most guys get over these feelings pretty quickly. Dads whose baby was conceived using donor sperm and aren't biologically connected have their own kind of irrational fears. A lot of guys worry that they won't be able to bond with their baby, or that sperm samples have been switched and that they'll end up with a child of a different race. Actually, the issue isn't so much race as physical similarity. Most IVF couples don't feel the need to make the circumstances of their pregnancy public. And like other dads, they hope their children will look like them. At least enough so that they won't have to deal with the inevitable comments like, gee, the baby doesn't look anything like you. They may choose to tell the kids the true story of their birth later on, but it's a topic we'll tackle in the sequel to this book, The New Father, A Dad's Guide to the First Year. Staying Involved, Helping Her Cope with Morning Sickness. Somewhere between half and 90% of all pregnant women experience morning sickness. Despite the catchy name, the nausea, heartburn, and vomiting can strike at any hour of the day. No one's quite sure what causes morning sickness. Some suggest that it's the pregnant woman's reaction to changing hormone levels, in particular HCG, which is produced by the placenta and is the same stuff that's picked up by home pregnancy kits. Others, such as researchers Margie Proffitt, Samuel Flaxman, and Paul Sherman, contend that morning sickness is the body's natural way of protecting the growing fetus from toxins that cause birth defects or could induce a miscarriage. Morning sickness seems to go hand in hand with food aversions, which a lot of pregnant women also have. The most common aversions are to meat, fish, poultry, and eggs, all foods that can spoil quickly and can carry disease. Whatever the cause, for most women, morning sickness typically starts 4 to 6 weeks after conception and disappears by 14 to 15 weeks. Until then, here are a few things you can do to help your partner cope. You can start by giving her some good news. It turns out morning sickness may actually be a good thing. Women who don't vomit or have nausea are 3 times more likely to miscarry than those who do have those symptoms, according to researcher Gideon Corin. And women over 35, whose risk of miscarriage is higher, benefited the most. In addition, women with morning sickness are less likely to deliver too early, to have very low birth weight babies, or to have babies with birth defects. Oh, and those babies have higher IQs. Knowing this probably won't make your partner feel a whole lot better, but it might give her something to smile about as she's leaning over the toilet bowl. Encourage her to drink a lot of fluids, although some women with morning sickness have trouble tolerating milk. You might also want to keep a large water bottle next to the bed. She should avoid caffeine, which tends to be dehydrating, and she might want to start the day with a small amount of non-acidic juice, such as apple or grape or flat soda. The sweet flavor will probably encourage her to drink a little more than she might otherwise. Be sensitive to the sights and smells that make her queasy, and keep them away from her. Fatty or spicy foods are frequent offenders. Encourage her to eat a lot of small meals throughout the day, every 2 or 3 hours if possible, and to eat before she starts feeling nauseated. Low blood sugar can make the nausea worse. A high-protein, high-carbohydrate diet may help. And basic, bland foods like rice and yogurt are particularly good because they're less likely to cause nausea than greasy foods. Go for a walk. Some women find that exercise reduces nausea. Make sure she takes her prenatal vitamins with food if her doctor says to do so. He may also suggest that she take some additional vitamin B and K. For some women, though, the prenatal vitamins may actually make the morning sickness worse. OB Lissa Rankin often switches her patients to a chewable vitamin. If that doesn't work, she takes them off the vitamins altogether for a few months. She says that it's more important to stay hydrated and take in some nutrients than to take a vitamin. Put some pretzels, crackers, or rice cakes by the bed. She'll need something to start and end the day with, and these are low in fat and calories and easy to digest. You might want to explore some alternative treatments. Acupressure bands that press on the inside of the wrist have reduced symptoms in some women, and so has eating or drinking ginger or taking vitamin B6 supplements. In addition, some research indicates that sniffing peppermint oil and isopropyl alcohol, that's the stuff they rub on your arm before giving you a shot, can shorten the duration of symptoms. But be sure to check with her practitioner before she starts sniffing or eating or pressing on anything. Finally, be aware that she needs plenty of rest and encourage her to get it. Let's move on to some of the other important ways you can be involved this month. Exercise. If your partner was already working out regularly before the pregnancy, she probably won't need any extra encouragement to exercise. If her doctor approves, she can continue her regular fitness routine and do pretty much any kind of working out she wants. We'll talk about some exceptions to that in just a minute. Be aware, though, that some health clubs, probably out of fear of getting sued, may ask a pregnant woman to provide a letter from her doctor. If your partner wasn't physically active before getting pregnant, this is not the time for her to take up rock climbing or start training for a marathon. That doesn't mean, however, that she should spend the entire pregnancy on the sofa. Getting exercise is critical. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, recommends 30 minutes per day of moderate exercise. It will help improve her circulation and keep her energy level high. Exercising during pregnancy may also help your partner keep her weight gain steady and reasonable, help her sleep better, improve her mood, and reduce some of the normal pregnancy-related discomforts. Plus, it will improve her strength and endurance, both of which will come in very handy during labor and delivery. Researchers James Clapp and Elizabeth Noble found that women who exercise during their pregnancy have shorter labors and give birth to healthier babies. Others, including Bradley Price, have found that exercise may even lessen the chance that your partner will deliver prematurely, have complications during labor, or need a cesarean section. And then there's Canadian neuroscientist Dave Ellenberg, who found that compared to couch potato expectant moms, pregnant women who did 20 minutes of moderate exercise, meaning that they were slightly short of breath by the end, three times a week, had babies with more mature cerebral activation. Translation? Their brains develop more quickly. Ellenberg believes that these babies could learn to speak and reach other developmental milestones sooner. But because pregnancy can make even the buffest woman feel a little run down, she may not always feel like working out. One way to help motivate her to get the exercise she needs is to work out with her. The most important thing is to start easy and not push her if you see she's feeling tired or winded. If your budget doesn't permit joining a gym or a health club, you can always buy pregnancy workout DVDs or even download pregnancy exercise apps to your phone. Whatever you do, remember that you and your partner will get the greatest benefit and least chance of injury if you exercise regularly, 30 minutes on as many days as you can, rather than sporadically. Here are some great ways of exercising together. Walking. Doesn't matter whether it's fast or slow, through your neighborhood, on a trail, or on a treadmill. Other low-impact aerobics and low-impact exercise machines such as stair steppers, treadmills, and bicycles are good too. If you're running, do yourselves and your knees a favor. Get good running shoes and run on a soft surface. If your partner likes the water, try swimming, water aerobics, or snorkeling. Cycling is excellent, whether it's stationary or on the street, but you should probably skip those bumpy dirt bike rides. Tennis or golf are fine, and so is a little weightlifting. And as the pregnancy progresses, she may enjoy yoga, but avoid extreme stretches because they can cause damage to your partner's connective tissue, which is already somewhat weakened during pregnancy. Before starting any kind of workout program, discuss the details with your provider and get his or her approval. If you're doing anything that will work up a sweat, be sure to get enough fluids. Both of you should drink a glass or so of water an hour before starting and another 4 to 8 ounces every 15 to 20 minutes while you're working out. Although exercise is a great thing, there are certain types of workouts that your partner should stay away from. Here are some of those workout no-nos. High-impact sports. I've spoken with dozens of OBGYNs over the years and have yet to find one who seriously believes that it's possible to induce a miscarriage by ordinary falling, especially in the first trimester. However, severe, sudden impact, such as car crashes, can sometimes cause a miscarriage. Same with sudden starts and stops, such as what might occur on a roller coaster. That said, it's a good idea to limit or avoid high-contact sports like boxing, hockey, or roller derby. You'll also want to pass on any sport that might cause her to take a hard fall. This includes horseback riding, inline skating, ice skating, and, starting at about the 7th month, bicycling. For a non-pregnant person, taking a tumble doing one of those sports could be dangerous. For someone who's having balance issues, the risks are even greater. Downhill skiing. Unless you're an expert, don't, and even then, take it easy. My wife skied when she was 7 months pregnant, but avoided the most challenging runs where she'd have risked a serious fall. Unless your partner's doctor prohibits it, cross-country skiing should be fine. Scuba diving is problematic because the fetus can't decompress like adults can, and so is heavy lifting, which can put unnecessary pressure on the internal organs. Be careful not to overdo it. As a general rule, if she can't carry on a normal conversation while exercising, she's working too hard.